This is a podcast for Journal of Applied Ecology, a British Ecological Society publication.
In today's episode, I'm joined by Dominic McAfee to discuss his paper entitled Soundscape Enrichment Enhances Recruitment and Habitat Building on New Oyster Reef Restorations. Dominic is one of this year's 12 shortlisted authors in with a chance of winning the Salford Prize. This prize is awarded annually to an author who has published in Journal of Applied Ecology in the previous year and aims to celebrate early career research. You can keep an eye on our blog, The Applied Ecologist, and our social media channels to find out the winner over the next few weeks. Without further ado, let's get started chatting to Dominic about his nominated research.
Okay, let's get started then. First question is, could you give us a bit of a background about yourself and how you got into ecology?
Sure thing. So my name's Dominic McAfee. I'm a marine ecologist at the University of Adelaide in sunny South Australia, very hot at the moment. And how I got here, I think I took a bit of a scenic route to becoming an ecologist, a career ecologist. I always love spending time in nature, but I was rubbish at school and didn't do very well at all, even in biology, my favorite subject. So I spent a lot of time backpacking in my 20s and was always sort of trying to get lost in nature. And then when I eventually got the opportunity to go to university as a mature age student, very immature, mature age 25-year-old, I wanted to study something to do with the environmental sciences. Also love volcanoes. So I was actually studying to be a volcanologist, not very useful in Australia. We don't have any volcanoes, but it did take me to Iceland. And it was on a field trip there when I came across a whale that had long dead, rotting away on the shoreline. And I was just absolutely captivated by this dead whale and looking at the bone structure. And that was it. I went home. I got out of geology and volcanology and transitioned to ecology. And I've never looked back.
Wow. Like you said, definitely a more unusual pathway into it, perhaps.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it's really stuck.
It definitely has, yeah.
Yeah, I relate in some ways. Like I did a geography degree, which really enjoyed. So you're talking about like volcanoes, stuff like that, but ended up in this job, obviously in ecology. And it's funny because things they obviously interlink, but also quite different. I've had to like learn quite a lot of new information, but that's what makes it quite enjoyable, I think.
yeah, absolutely. And I've really enjoyed sort of, so first and foremost, I've been working on oyster ecosystems for over a decade now. But working in ecology brings me increasingly in contact with other disciplines, the social sciences, law, economics, because humanity is trying to grapple with how we manage and engage with the environment for a more sustainable future. And it requires this complex multidisciplinary approach. And it's been absolutely wonderful being able to sort of work in nature, but also see how other disciplines engage with it. And I just have wonderful conversations all day long with people who come, who view ecosystems completely differently. And I'm completely naive of what they do, and they're naive of what I do, and it makes for magic.
Yeah, I think definitely, especially if when you're working on like research together and you come at it from that angle, you can pick up on everyone's strengths and create something really nice at the end, effectively. Can you briefly summarise the research in your paper and how it advances the field?
Yeah, absolutely. It's this research is sort of centered around marine restoration ecology. So in Australia, we had these our marine ecosystems are very degraded, like everywhere in the world. And the most degraded ecosystem are these shellfish reefs, these oyster reefs that have been lost globally, 85% in Australia, about 99% wiped from the seafloor over the last 200 years. So over the last 7 years, we've been working really diligently with industry and government to start to bring them back. And one of the challenges with restoring essentially an extinct ecosystem is ensuring that you can have a supply of proper gules, finding and interacting and using your restoration sites, so we can start to bring back the habitat foundations that we need to restore an ecosystem. So this is all about reprovisioning some of the environmental information that other animals use to find and select a place to live.
Yeah.
And we focused on soundscape ecology because marine animals, they use all sorts of cues to find a home. They use smell and sight to a certain degree, but at a broader spatial scale, sound is a really important component of how organisms navigate.
Yeah.
So we tested out what would happen if we could reprovision some of the sounds associated with a healthy habitat to see if we could sort of draw in more propagules at our restoration sites. So that involved some pretty quirky bucket science at first to test the theory in the lab. And we ran all sorts of experiments playing all sorts of different sound to oyster larvae because we want to restore this native oyster. And eventually, this particular paper describes what happened when we then took that out into the field and put speakers, which were homemade speakers because we had a very shoestring budget, homemade speakers on new reef restorations. So boulders that have gone down, reefs constructed out of limestone boulders, which are a really appropriate substrate for oysters to settle on, good chemical cues and good physical structure for the oysters to attach to. And we played healthy habitat sounds on those reefs, and the results were unbelievable.
Can you tell us a bit about your results?
Yeah, absolutely. So we, in South Australia, we've got some of the biggest oyster restoration projects, certainly in the Southern Hemisphere, but even in the world. And so we put our speakers out on two large reef restorations, one 20-hectare reef restoration and a 5-hectare one. And we had 10 sites where we placed speakers over quite a large coastline. And we played the sounds of a healthy reef ecosystem, which we recorded from the healthiest reef ecosystem in the a rocky reef ecosystem in the area. And we had about, on average, 5,000 more oyster larvae settling per meter squared in the presence of our speakers rather than in the absence.
Wow.
So really powerful. And that was a significant difference at 8 of our 10 sites. So really, really powerful response. And that's just over a two-week period, actually. So that was using sediment panels. Over 5 months, we then monitored what happened on the actual boulders of the reef. And we saw more oysters settling sooner, which resulted in more large oysters forming more three-dimensional habitat, which is really what we need to restore to bring back those physical foundations that the oysters provide when they build three-dimensional habitat, provides a home to all sorts of other animals. So we're able to accelerate that process just by playing sound for the first 5 months of a reef restoration.
Crazy. Very, very, very impressive results, definitely. And yeah. And the fact that, like you said, you literally were building some of this stuff yourself, that's, yeah.
Yeah, that was a nightmare. But enjoy an exciting journey as well. We partnered with an engineering NGO, Environmental Conservation Technology Group called Ocean. They're a local group, and actually one of the employees is a former honours student. they've employed upon a few of our students, and that's made for a really sort of productive collaboration.
Yeah.
So we told them what we wanted. Built all these different prototypes of speakers. We flooded so many speakers, but we can build them really cheap. And when a commercial speaker costs, I think with all the components, about $3,000 or $4,000, so maybe that's £2,000.
Yeah.
Our budget really didn't accommodate for that, so we were able to manufacture about 20 speakers with rechargeable batteries, and we'd have to continually recharge those, and then go back into the field every 5 to 6 days. It was a lot of work to keep those speakers running. It was exhausting. Yeah. And one of the things we did is we really had to restrict the sound as well to just about a 10 to 20 meter radius as well. So we weren't blanketing the reef and therefore potentially disturbing the broader ecology. It was just the things that were kind of floating past anyway.
Yeah,
that would be able to interpret and engage with that sound. So to see those sorts of responses over such a small spatial scale is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I suppose that actually leads on perfectly. So have you continued this research?
Yes, yes, we have. And a lot of our focus has been on bad sound. So this we call this good sound, your natural sound. Mm-hmm. Biophony produced by the little animals that make the sound of an ecosystem, mainly snapping shrimp, snapping their claws, but also other animals feeding. So some of this speaker work we conducted in an urbanized estuary where there was quite a bit of background noise pollution. It's next to a busy road. There's a lot of industry in the area. We found that the speakers didn't have an impact on recruitment there. So we suspected that there was potentially a masking. There was still larvae out in the water column floating around, but there was no response at our speaker sites. So we suspected that maybe it's to do with noise pollution. We're still drilling down into that. But it did seem that more the other sites were offshore on sedimentary areas, which were pretty much devoid of very little sound, natural or anthropogenic. But this was a noisy estuary with hard concrete walls, so the sound was just bouncing around everywhere. So we suspect that it was that noise pollution that was masking the effect of our speakers, as I said, the not really loud speakers. So we've continued to look at that. And in the lab, we've been playing this bad sound, shipping sound, motorboat sound, to oysters, and pardon the pun, they clam up, they stop feeding and doing the providing their usual functions in the presence of that sound. They do acclimatize to it, but yeah, it does seem to have a negative impact.
No, that's really interesting. Well, not entirely surprising, I suppose, to some extent, that, you know, anthropogenic factors potentially have this negative impact. But yeah, sounds really interesting to keep developing that and working on it. And
yeah, we really don't know the full extent of what anthropogenic noise pollution is doing to the marine environment. For one thing, there's hardly any published research on the component of sound that marine invertebrates actually use, because they don't have ears. So they don't hear sounds per se. They more feel sounds, because we hear sound pressure, which we interpret with our eardrums, as do all marine mammals. But fishes and a lot of invertebrates use particle motion that's created by the sound wave as it moves through a medium, as it moves through the water, which rattles little particles, and gradients in that particle rattling can be followed. It's hard research to do because there aren't that many instruments that detect particle motion in the frequency range that's meaningful for these invertebrates. So there's a lot of work to be done in that space. And until we really understand what noise pollution does to invertebrates and larvae, who are really important, their recruitment's essential for keeping ecosystems functional. Until we understand that, we don't know what the full impacts of sound pollution are.
Mm. Yeah, so definitely you're kind of on the forefront of developing research here. And I suppose this moves on again quite nicely. If you had to pick maybe one thing that you enjoyed the most about conducting the research, what do you think you would say?
The journey of discovery has been astonishing with this particular work. So the paper talks about what kind of felt like a bit of an end product after 5 years of a lot of work in the lab and troubleshooting with the technicians. Another paper that's actually published in Journal of Applied Ecology, led by my PhD student, we built an 8 meter long tank, which we called the Oyster Raceway. And we put oyster larvae in the middle. And for a really tiny microscopic little larvae, to demonstrate that they will swim laterally over meters towards our speakers was pretty startling. We put 40,000 odd larvae in that tank, and they all swam, all the ones that left that central area, all swam in the direction of the speaker. Really powerful cue. So that sense of discovery has been really rich and rewarding and kept us going on cold mornings. But I would say probably the most enjoyable part of all of it has been communicating to the broader public. It's just a lot of fun to talk about this research. And you see, it's kind of been a little bit normalized for me, but when I have conversations with people and I mention it and see the jaw hit the floor, I'm like, oh, wow, yes, I am working in a very novel, unusual space.
Yeah, definitely. I think I remember actually, because you'd written a blog post about this research, and I remember it had a nice reception. It was received very well. Yeah.
Oh, great. That's wonderful to hear. We often don't know how our research is being received. I'm not prolific on social media. I sort of shy away from that a little bit. So it's nice. I went to, I work on so many different things. It's not just the sound. And I went to a conference recently, and there was people from all parts, all corners of the world who knew about that particular research and really wanted to chat, and were just spoke of their excited office conversations. that was really nice.
Yeah, definitely. It's nice having that more connection with the wider ecological community, I think. But what would you say is the best thing about being an ecologist more broadly?
Well, for me, again, because I really love telling the story, ecology provides a lot of stories.
Yeah.
And my favourite story to tell is that of the oysters. You know, they're kind of an unsung hero of the global ecology and a largely forgotten ecosystem. So for me, of course, being able to spend time in nature and dedicating my life to understanding how nature ticks, and being comfortable with the idea that that it's so complex and we're never really going to be able to get we know a lot, but we know a lot. There's a lot more that we don't know.
Yeah.
But it's communicating. It's communicating and sharing ecological stories with the broader community, and being able to, nature is just so full of wonder that there's so many stories to tell, and I really enjoy that side of things. I love presenting to local communities, and particularly communities that don't get engaged that often.
Yeah.
I like going out to rural parts of the coastline here, and even inland, and I'll always talk at schools whenever I get the opportunity, because I think what I do is pretty fun, and it's exciting to see people engage with it.
Yeah.
People kind of glaze over when I mention oysters, so I don't talk about oysters too much, but that's my real passion is bringing oyster ecology and oyster restoration to the masses. And I enjoy the challenge of making that fun and engaging.
Yeah, definitely. And it's that that notion of you're doing something that's actually giving back to obviously the environment and to people as well. And there's something definitely really nice about that. To flip that question the other way, what would you say is perhaps the worst thing about being an ecologist, or something that perhaps could be built upon more, or worked upon? A lot of people mention funding, for example.
Don't get me started. Whatever you think. we don't have all night. From a personal perspective, I share the water with some really big sharks. That definitely rattles your nerves sometimes, depending on where the sites are. Some of our sites are very sharky, so that's not fun. Also, in the back of COVID, universities flat broke. So many people have been let go, and that constant uncertainty of working as an academic really does wear you down. And I've sort of been thinking long and hard about whether or not It's the best use of my energy, which is sad because it's definitely a hard industry to stay in. I also think that, I mean, the funding models are just incredibly frustrating when relative to the value of nature to humankind. And in Australia, the value of this is a, the culture in Australia is very much coastal. People all flock to the beaches. They want to go fishing, spend time on the sand or underwater. And it's just very much under-resourced, even though we have this, you know, all the time we're seeing incredible advances and solutions sort of staring us in the face. You know, that uphill mountain, that constant battle, there's only a few degrees of separation between the restoration program that I'm working on being a really big success and sort of being a flash in the pan. It might not be the long-term success that we hope it is if just a few energetic people were to not be involved. So, yeah, it's a bit disconcerting that it really comes down to a lot of people working in very uncertain circumstances to make sure that, yeah, this work is properly funded and has a future.
Yeah, yeah. I know a lot of people, when they speak about funding and things, it's the idea that how exactly do you quantify nature? It's then very hard. You put a lot of time and energy into writing these proposals, and ultimately how do you kind of say, oh, one thing is more important than another thing, and when ultimately everything is integrated and everything is important in the environment in general.
I spend 3 to 4 months writing some of the big grants, and it is, you know, really for minimal money that you have to do that on a biannual basis, and yeah, it's really a bit soul sapping and soul crushing at times when the rejection rates are very high.
I suppose something to take from that is, if you were speaking to someone who's interested in getting into ecology or into your field more specifically, if you could give them perhaps one piece of kind of key advice, what do you think you would tell them?
To think long and hard about how you can make your research have impact. That sounds pretty obvious. But one of the things I've always done, I'm very fortunate that I do get to work, I have a very close working relationship with the state government here, which means that these papers, they have the opportunity to have uptake. And that's not by chance. I've looked at the needs and the documents of industry and government in the local area and looked to align my research with that. Certainly when I started working in this space back in 2012, when I did my honours year, there was no discussion around the restoration of this ecosystem, shellfish reefs or oyster reefs at that particular time. So I worked closely with the aquaculture industry just to make sure that there was some sort of uptake. And then when I saw there was an opportunity to work in the restoration space, I looked at, you know, what were the knowledge gaps and worked hard to fill those. So a lot of that lack of knowledge was around where and when restoration might be possible. And from an ecologist perspective, tying that to the reproductive cycles of oysters and just where they disperse, when they disperse, when we should put rocks in the water to make sure that, to provide an evidence-based approach to this restoration work. And so that was really just by doing my own due diligence to make sure my research was aligned with current needs.
Okay, yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I suppose that sort of thing, like you said, that will then help to secure funding or you know, people to help you along the way, because I think ecology is perhaps, so the idea is changing a bit from old notions of kind of doing things on your own, very individual. I think it's become a lot more collaborative.
Yeah, all of the big grants in Australia, your big government grants, you have to pass a national interest test. That's very easy with my work. It's not as easy with some more sort of blue sky conceptual science. But yeah, from my perspective, you need to make sure that you're listening to what people are saying. And if people aren't saying anything, then you can fill the void.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of ear on the ground kind of thing. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. That brings us to the end of the podcast recording. Thank you very, very much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a long and very hot day. So hopefully that all made sense. But I'm absolutely knackered.